49 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I am a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today, it'll just be me talking. And what I want to cover is a discussion about autonomy in U.S. Latin American relations. And this is going to be based on a book project, actually, that I've embarked on. And the goal of this project is to have a book that's both that's looking at U.S. Latin American relations in the 21st century, so it's contemporary without the historical background like my U.S. and Latin American relations text has. And it's supposed to be a combination, really, of a new way of a fresh way, I should say, of looking at U.S. Latin American relations, but then also accessible so that it could be used in the classroom. So it's not a textbook per se, but it's supposed to at least really be something that would work well in classrooms. And I presented the first chapter, so the intro chapter of the book, which is really just very much in draft form, at the annual meeting, the conference of the Southeastern Conference of Latin American Studies. And that was just held just a couple weeks ago in Nashville, Tennessee. And I've been a longtime member of the organization, and I edit the journal that the organization owns, the Latin Americanist. So I've gone to Scholas for years. It's always a great conference, and I want to give a plug for next year, so that at the end of March of 2019, it will be held in Oaxaca, Mexico. And we're all in the organization, we're all really excited about this location. And so if you're listening to this, that means you're interested in Latin American politics, particularly if you are in academia, then you should consider presenting a paper at Scholas next year. The call for papers will be out probably not in the too distant future, so that people can plan. But I'll be posting that on my blog, and just in general, you can look for it. Scholas also has a Twitter feed and a Facebook page, so feel free to connect that way. But coming back to the research question itself, the basic question for the book that I'm the way I'm sort of framing it is, so how can we best understand the major shifts in U.S. Latin American relations that have taken place in the 21st century? And we know there's a lot going on. We've seen the growth of new institutions. There is a host of new global influences. We know, of course, that after the election of Hugo Chavez, there were all kinds of changes taking place in Latin America. I'd say not as simple as a lot of people frame them, and I try to really get at this in the book, that we do see all these changes, but honestly, the ideological lens, the left-right sort of binary approach, I argue, is really not useful. There's too much variation there. There's too much complexity to be able to break Latin America into these two parts. That's really kind of a Cold War era way of doing it, And I think we lose a lot more than we gain by trying to do that. For years have been sort of making this argument. It's always like there's the good left and there's the bad left. Like that's basically as much nuance as you get. And so I explicitly get away from that way of looking at things. And so to start with sort of answering this question of understanding these changes that have taken place, what I try to do is to look to the Latin American literature on international relations, and particularly, of course, on U.S. Latin American relations more specifically. And this is one thing that you don't see nearly enough of in the study of U.S. Latin American relations in the United States. And, you know, of course, you know, I can't be casting a stone from a glass house, you know, because honestly, that includes me. So if you look at the various things that I've published on U.S. Latin American relations, even what I've done often is to try and advance to contribute to a literature that's based largely in the United States. And, you know, that's often what we're reading, and that's what we're assigning in class. But you just dig just a very small amount, especially in Spanish, and you find that there are a tremendous amount of articles and books that we in the United States miss. Now, sometimes I suppose, you know, language can be a problem for, at least for mainstream IR people. If you're not studying Latin America, then you might not know Spanish. But what I found is that we in the United States are looking at really different things than in Latin America. We're emphasizing different kinds of things. And one concept that shows up so often in the Latin American literature and very rarely in the U.S. literature is autonomy. You do see it every once in a while in a U.S. journal. Very often it is a Latin American author who's publishing in English. But that's really not a typical sort of thing, is that this is mostly being published in Latin America. So what I found is that in Latin America there's all this discussion over years about autonomy, about what autonomy is, about whether autonomy should be a goal. But all of it was based on the premise that autonomy was something that was critical for Latin America to figure out, to understand one way or another. And if you look at the U.S. literature, you just don't see it. In the U.S. literature, it's a focus that's much more U.S.-centric and much more bound in U.S. theories, realism, etc., with this question of U.S. hegemony is central to it often. In Latin America, it's different. So the one of the most important scholars for understanding autonomy, or, you know, who had published and cited a lot, is Juan Carlos Puig, an Argentine scholar. And actually, you find that a lot of this is a lot of authors are Argentine, and this seems to me to be following a pretty long tradition of Argentine scholars, especially legal scholars, trying to theorize about Latin America's relationship with the United States, really Latin America's relationship with the world. And, you know, Puig argues that that both dependency theory and realism, which are the sort of predominant grand theories, and this is he's publishing this in the 70s and into the 80s, that both of those are really inadequate. And they're not helping us really understand the things that Latin American leaders are doing and the way in which Latin America is responding to the United States. Escudé, another Argentine scholar, he takes it and says, you know, another thing we got to realize, unlike, say, dependency theory, is that autonomy shouldn't necessarily be an end. Is that sometimes costs of trying to embrace autonomy are too high, and they have to be taken into account. Meaning, often that if your actions are going to antagonize the U.S. and create backlash, well, then maybe that's not worth pursuing. So, in general, I'm not going to provide a whole literature review, but the way that these things get framed is that power is real. You know, the power of the United States is a major variable to take into account. But Latin American countries are doing a lot more than according to dependency theory, just sort of trying to break away. And B, they're not simply passive. There's a lot going on that neither realism nor dependency theory really captures theoretically. And in the U.S. Latin America context, it means the pursuit, of independent policies. So policies that don't like, let's say, international organizations that don't include the United States, pursuit of agreements that are that either economic or political. So it could be free trade agreements, it could be diplomatic agreements, it could be military agreements, etc., with a broader array of partners globally. And this is the sort of thing with two categories of economic and political that I start that I'm starting to try to get at. What I try to argue, however, is to say that, and this is kind of key to the theme of the book, is that we shouldn't see all of these as automatic rejection of the U.S. So that it's not simply a, okay, U.S. Projects power and then Latin America rejects that use of power and then acts accordingly. And I'm going to argue instead that there's other things going on. And I have three main threads to my to the argument. And then what the book does is try to trace these. And it's the way I have it planned is that it's roughly chronological. So I don't just sort of this happens, but to sort of show how this evolution occurred with a focus on, you know, starting really the very end of the 20th century and then predominantly looking at the 21st century. But the first part of my argument is that structural adjustment policies shifted traditional views away from reliance on the United States. So with the debt crisis of the 1980s and the end of the import substitution industrialization model, Latin American countries moved from an inward look to an export-oriented look. I'm not saying anything new. But what I argue is that this prompted a complete change in how Latin American countries viewed the role of the United States. So the U.S., of course, was very much in favor of structural adjustment policies. It was pushing them. It was at the forefront of this. But at least an unintended consequence is that Latin American countries saw, okay, well, if I'm exporting, well, then I can't only be exporting to the U.S. And that just was, I mean, this it's not as if there was a light bulb going off, but rather, you know, this seemed to make sense that, you know, what the U.S. was pushing for was kind of a more globalized look. And that's then what Latin American countries started to pursue. My second point is that all governments wanted to seek new markets. And the point here is that ideology didn't matter. Ideology didn't matter. So we normally see leftist governments as just rejecting the U.S. Okay, so that if you're trying to find new markets, that you're rejecting the U.S. And this could, you know, this you could say this about Venezuela, for example, that leftist governments tended to say, or at least, you know, as to say, not necessarily always do, but what they would say is that we need to shift our dependence away from the United States and diversify. So either explicitly or implicitly, they were embracing the ideals of dependency theory. And I think with Hugo Chavez sometimes, even perhaps Rafael Correa, you would hear they were clearly talking about dependency theory. And this was rejection of the U.S., saying, okay, we need to break away from the capitalist bonds that the United States has shackled us with. However, these things were also happening with conservative governments or center-right governments. They were taking they embraced structural adjustment, whereas leftist governments rejected structural adjustment. Actually, they came to power in rejection of it. But on the flip side, governments on the right were saying, we are an ally of the U.S. We are all in favor of U.S. Free trade policies. And that means that we need to find new trading partners. So they were becoming more autonomous, or at least moving in that direction, creating new relationships with China, with other Asian countries, with India, with Russia, who, you know, just literally all a wide variety of countries, so that no matter which economic, any economic model you're looking at, those governments were all trying to find new markets. And what that was going to mean was that their reliance on the United States would decrease. And this varied across countries. And this is one of the things that now I'm trying to really make sure I make clear, make sense of, is, you know, what kind of variation, can we make sense of the variation? Because with some countries, the trade with the U.S. versus other countries was, the change was great, particularly with regard to China. And as I point out in the book, I start in chapter two, is that at the same time, the Chinese leaders were changing their own economic model, and in the 1990s were reaching out more toward Latin America. So precisely at the moment, and these two things were not, you know, they weren't initially tied together, but they came together where just at the moment Latin American countries wanted new markets, China was looking for new markets. And that was not planned that way. And China was not automatically trying to, you know, it wasn't as if they had this ideological project. They were trying to make more money. And they were eager to find these new markets regardless of the ideology of the leader in question. And so there were countries on the left, countries on the right, that tried to really forge these new, stronger bonds with China. And that accelerated this push toward autonomy. And then my third point is that at the same time, this with the end of the Cold War, it meant there was much more flexibility for leftist governments to pursue autonomous policies. So in the Cold War, many of these things would have met with very stiff resistance from the U.S. and perhaps use of hard power to stop them. But in the post-Cold War period, and especially as we get into the 21st century, is that leftist governments really of any kind, could be a little more antagonistic. They could create new institutions, excluded the U.S., that harshly criticized the U.S. They could forge relationships with adversaries of the United States, Russia, Iran, whatever the case might be, and they could really actively try and shift emphasis on the sort of the traditional relationship with the U.S. and become more global. So there was more pragmatism in general, and just much more space. So all of these things were really coming together at the same time. I try to avoid cliche, so I'm not going to write anything about perfect storm or anything like that. But all of these things were coming together at that point, really, as the end of the 20th century was ending. And so what the chapters of the book try to do is trace these three things and show how they developed. So the sort of three basic conclusions that I expect to make is that the pursuit of autonomy is not neatly tied to ideology. And I think this is an important one because the conventional wisdom tends to suggest this. Rejection of the U.S. is often not the goal. And third, that across the region, it's tied to larger processes. Now, one question I got at Scholus, which is a good one, is that, I get similar kinds of questions from students because I'm teaching my undergraduate U.S. Latin American Relations class right now, is, what about Trump? And, Trump has been in office just sort of long enough so we can start seeing patterns. And the one thing, the one way in which I think it could influence the book, or at least the perhaps the last chapter of the book, is that I argue that rejection of the United States is often not the goal. And I do think that with Trump, we'll have to tweak. I'll have to tweak it just a bit to say, is that not only in this case is rejection not the goal, is that Latin American countries don't want to reject the United States. They actually don't want to. And in the case of even countries that should be our allies, they don't want to reject the U.S. and they're just like, okay, we honestly have no choice. And this, I just thought of this because of the article that just came out yesterday in the New York Times, and I blogged about it this morning, so you can feel free, if you want the link, you could see what I said about it, but then also you can get a link to the article itself if you go to my blog with 2 weeks notice at weeksnotice.blogspot.com. And what the article argues is that the Trump administration's trade policies, which are essentially protectionist, are prompting Latin American countries to pare back their own protectionist policies, like Brazil. Brazil's been protectionist. Now Brazil's like, okay, well, we don't like this steel tariff. And then to forge more trade relationships with each other in Latin America. And the one quote from this article that really struck me was is from Sebastián Piñera. And Piñera is somebody who should be a close ally of a Republican president. He just should be. And so should Mauricio Macri in Argentina. If you have a conservative presence of the right in Latin America, they are natural allies of a Republican president, and yet we are antagonizing them. And what Piñera said was that, quote, "I think that with this attitude, the United States is leaving a void, and that void may be filled by China. The president of the United States was defending protectionism, and the president of China was defending free trade. It felt a little like the world upside down." This is a president saying this, and that has been something floating around from academics and from political analysts, pundits, and now it's reached conventional wisdom. The president of a country has said it, and you know that many other presidents agree with it. And you can just see that what Piñera is saying is that we're gonna, you know, Chile, of course, is already a highly globalized economy, but that natural allies of the United States are now gonna be saying, we're gonna pull away from the U.S. Not that we want to, but the U.S. is pushing at us, and so we have no choice. The U.S. is enacting punitive policies, so we have no choice. And so the funny thing about Trump is that it's not only that countries aren't rejecting it, but they would honestly prefer not to. And I would imagine that once Trump's out of office, that they will try to regain the positions that they had before with the United States. However, even then, what we're going to see is some of the relationships they forge during this time will become permanent. They will become permanent. And so that push away from the United States is something that was entirely avoidable. And, you know, just in general, the Trump presidency is throws a wrench in things because, of course, he's doing things differently than any other president. But the basic arguments are still going to hold, is that those processes were still going on. And we're moving in a direction where Latin America is slowly, at least most of Latin America, becoming more autonomous. There are exceptions, as I said, I'm trying to really get at those and understand those without just rationalizing them or kind of explaining them away. And it just might be that Trump is accelerating this process more than than his predecessors have. And so that is the basic premise of the book. I've been pointing at this a little bit in my blog over the past six-ish months, I'd say, as I've embarked on it. And what I expect is that as I finish more, then I'll talk about those too. If you are interested in reading a copy of the first chapter, you want to provide comments, I'm very much in the comment phase. I'm happy to send it out. You can just send me an email at gbweeks at uncc.edu. And as we're past the 25-minute mark, I'll go ahead and leave it at that. Thank you so much for listening, and then I'll see you next time on what will be episode number 50.